This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show's Main Street connects the state this time of day. And, of course, if you're out on a Main Street right now looking up in the sky, you might see a plane crossing our great state. Oftentimes throughout the day, if the clouds aren't there and it isn't snowing. But we're going to talk about aviation and specifically a brand new book by George Bible. George teaches mechanical engineering at the University of North Dakota, and he joins us from our microphone at the University of North Dakota. George, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Your new book is Plane Crash, The Forensics of Aviation Disasters. And previously, we've talked to you about Beyond the Black Box, The Forensics of Airplane Crashes. What prompted this new book?
Well, I'm certainly not here to say that flying is unsafe, but I study them for educational purposes. And I was able to connect with an airline pilot that gave an important point of view. And they keep crashing them, and it's a science book, and I like to discuss the safety improvements as well as the accidents, so we try to make it a happy book.
Well, your co-author is Captain Robert Hedges. He's an FAA pilot examiner. He's an instructor with a major U.S. airline. He's got lots of experience, 30 years of experience. So how did you put this book together working with him?
Well, I was very fortunate to connect with him. He's a certified Boeing/Airbus pilot, and he was in attendance at one of my talks, and we started talking to each other and trying to figure out if we could write a second book.
Well, the overall safety of modern aircraft, as you suggested, is remarkably good. So what were you looking for when you were writing this book?
Well, we're looking for a variety of things. We're looking for interesting stories. We're looking for science we can understand and explain. It really is rocket science, and everything's proprietary, but quite a bit of information leaks out in the official reports. So we're trying to write a storybook that teaches science, or a science book that tells stories, is the way I usually try to put it.
Well, you do tell stories, and you look at it from a mechanical engineer's perspective, or for that matter, with Captain Hedges, a pilot's perspective. Let's go back and touch on some of these disasters that have been widely reported and still some mysteries that connected with them, but we have learned some things. For example, Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, which is about 4 years ago, an overnight flight that took off after midnight with 239 passengers and crew aboard a Boeing 777, a very relatively modern aircraft. What lessons from that mystery have been applied?
Well, I think the aviation world knows what happened, which is some bad person, either a flight crew or a terrorist, did something bad. Now, you got to understand the crash investigation process. They really can't say anything without hard facts. And in the absence of hard facts, we're kind of left with this this big black hole to imagine things. Things that have happened in the past that might be relevant. Some people think, for example, it could be hypoxia, which happened to Boeing 737 in Greece in 2005.
So people suffocate?
Yes. Well, they all passed out, and the plane flew on autopilot till they ran out of fuel, and everyone died. But that's not the case with the missing plane, because it changed directions twice, and it shut off an awful lot of communication equipment. ACARS, a transponder, kind of a ADS-B, which is an updated GPS-based transponder, and, well, there are five radios on board, too. Just the lack of any radio communication is extremely suspicious.
So 4 years later, do we have a better way to track aircraft over big bodies of water like oceans?
Surprisingly, that's still a struggle. They're making their way towards it. One of the problems is you have big modern first world airlines with frequent flights, and they have very sophisticated tracking service systems in place already. Not as safe part of safety. They're not really worried about losing a plane, just optimize the business of flying. And then you have smaller countries might have one flight a day or even less, and they do absolutely nothing. So trying to get establish world standards that everyone agrees to is problematic. There's two satellite systems, for example, to track planes over oceans, and they're completely incompatible. You install one or the other. One has synchronous satellites that about 24,000 miles high and rotate with the Earth and stay in the same position. The other one has lower satellites that maybe 300 or 400 miles up, and they orbit every 90 minutes. So it's completely incompatible transmission systems to talk to each other. One of them, you need a lot more power to reach up 24,000 miles. The other one, you need a lot less. You need a complicated tracking algorithm to track all those satellites zipping around. So they're still struggling with that problem, believe it or not.
Well, let's talk about Air France Flight 447, May 31st, 2009, another overnight flight. This one had 228 passengers, a crew, on board an Airbus A330, another relatively modern aircraft. What lessons from that disaster have been applied?
Well, there's a lot of things that apply to the missing Malaysian plane. First of all, it was a really confused search. The plane took off at 8:30 at night, and they didn't launch planes looking for it until 8 o'clock the next morning. There were, I think, 9 different air traffic controller sites on both sides of the Atlantic yapping at each other for hours trying to figure out what happened. They just couldn't believe a plane was lost. They thought more likely somebody had a computer error in the schedule entry. So it took them a long time just to agree the plane was lost. And they did have that plane tracked down because of ACARS, which is also part of the Malaysian story. But with ACARS is sort of a maintenance thing. It's really not designed to track planes. But because of ACAR transmissions, they had this plane down. The Air France Flight 447 down to a 45-mile radius circle, and it still took them 2 years to find the plane. And rumor has it they're very close to giving up. Mm-hmm. And they searched that's about a 66,000-square-mile area, a little bit larger in size of Connecticut. They called the search off for the missing Malaysian plane after searching about the size of Ohio, 46,000 square miles. And the reason the plane was lost, it's still a common problem for big planes. An ordinary failure, in this case, the pitot tubes are freezing intermittently, which measures airspeed. And the autopilot cannot fly the plane if it doesn't know the speed. So the autopilot shut off with an alarm, said, "Mr. Pilot, take over." And if you combine that with confused pilots, they're not supposed to be confused. That's why they have many thousands of hours experience. But it still happens. The plane got out of position and stalled and fell out of the sky.
Well, And that's stunning that it happened the way it did. And, of course, that they found this plane ultimately at the bottom of a pretty deep ocean as well and brought it up, or good chunks of it at any rate, and discovered that the pitot tubes were something to be looked at.
Well, once they got the black boxes, they could figure it all out. But it was a great mystery till they got the black boxes. They tried to this was the biggest missing lost plane until the Malaysian flight. It was a few days before they recovered anything. There's only about 3% of fragments floating on the surface. The rest sunk to the bottom. And they tried to make sense out of the impact site, doing a computer simulation of ocean drift. And after 6 days, all the software they used differed by like 50, 60 miles. So very rapidly, they couldn't make sense out of anything.
Well, let's talk about a more successful emergency. And this one people will remember is the Miracle in the Hudson. Chesley Sullenberger, the pilot aboard U.S. Airways flight that left New York City in January 15, 2009 and got about a mile and a half before it landed safely in the Hudson River. All 155 people aboard that Airbus A320 survived. So what have we learned from that particular disaster?
Well, one important lesson that it hasn't happened in quite a while. People forgot about it. If a plane goes in the water under pilot control, You expect survivors. Those emergency chutes double as life rafts, and they all have radios on board. If it goes in the water out of control, well, that's a very serious problem. But if it goes in the water under control, in that case, it wasn't very deep water. They didn't have to worry about dealing with the rafts. But in the Malaysian flight or Air France, if they had a controlled water landing, you'd expect a much better, happier outcome. It's a bird strike, and they happened, had the misfortune of flying through a flock of geese shortly after takeoff.
So that can happen. Birds certainly live around airports, and especially airports near bodies of water. So is that a pretty sensitive period when you're taking off or landing, and you might get a bird in the engine?
Yes. Well, actually, the plane is, believe it or not, designed to complete a takeoff even if one engine conks out at the worst possible time. They call it decision speed or V1 speed. If they change their mind below V1 and abort the takeoff, everything's laid out so there's a safe distance to stop the plane. If they reach a speed above V1 and an engine conks out, they still have enough thrust to complete a safe takeoff.
But an 8-pound goose can bring down a plane. Let's talk about another near disaster that had a good ending, and that's Airbus A330 that left Toronto for Portugal on August 24th of 2001 with 306 passengers and crew. It ran out of fuel because there was a leak?
Yes. The engine had been in storage for a year and a half, and in the meantime, the engine had redesigned some of the plumbing, and the mechanic at 2 o'clock in the morning didn't track down the proper documentation and kind of mixed and matched old and new tubing, and they installed okay. When they got pressurized up to 3,000 PSI, there was a rub. And this is an example where the computers confuse things a little bit. Flying is most definitely safer because of increased computerization, but there's a few examples where the computer confuses things, and this is one of those examples. The pilots just could not believe they were run out of fuel. They thought it was a computer glitch. They didn't believe they ran out of fuel until the first engine went out, then the second engine went out, and they unpowered glide or 75 miles to a safe landing in the Azores,
which
is about 900 miles from where they're aiming in Portugal.
But that's pretty good, a plane that big with all those people on it gliding 75 miles. Obviously, it was at a pretty good altitude when it started doing that, but that was good piloting, I take it.
Yes, a typical glide ratio for a big airliner is 17, which means it can glide 17 feet horizontal for every foot it drops. So from 40,000 feet, that would be like 128 miles of gliding.
Wow. That's good to know. Somewhat soothing, I guess. Let's talk about another incident, though, that is etched in history, and that's United Flight 93. That's, of course, 9/11, 2001. One of those planes that crashed during a terrorist attack against our country. Has there ever been any discussion, considering that we talk about unmanned aircraft all the time these days, it's being studied in North Dakota and other places, has there ever been any discussion about remote override of airplane pilot controls?
Well, I'm a skeptic. I'm starting to think it's a generational thing. Most of my old engineering friends are skeptic too, and all the young engineers, they just assume that computers are going to take over everything. One of the examples I like to give, imagine a truck wandering on the runway at the absolute worst point of takeoff. Well, you can. The technology exists now. If you measure the distance, a computer can make a better, faster decision than the pilot. But that's not how it plays out. The FAA does a cost-benefit analysis on safety improvements, which involves putting a price on a human life, if you can imagine that. Something a company could never do because they'd get reamed in the court of public opinion, mm-hmm. and an actual court if they got sued over a safety issue. So if the problem is, if the example of that truck, Well, if it almost never happens, if you do the analysis, you'll conclude you can spend almost $0. Well, there's many dozens of things that almost never happen. It's going to be awfully tough. It's easier to keep the more cost effective to keep the pilot.
Well, we've talked about several of them already. How about air traffic control? That's been an issue that's been much in debate across this country. There's an important upgrade that I think still needs to be put in place, isn't there?
Yes, they're still phasing that in, and the whole point is to space planes closer safely. So it's essentially a new GPS system that can more computerized, that can track more planes, but there's still humans in the loop.
Well, there's another issue here, too, that we've talked about a bit around. What's more at fault, typically, in an aircraft disaster? Is it the plane, a mechanical failure of some sort, or is it pilot error?
Well, it depends on which bit of history you grab, and you almost have to invent a new combination of sequence to crash the plane because all the easy ones they've addressed. But typically, maybe half could be called human error, but there's other factors involved. For example, going back to that Air France 447 with the frozen pitot tubes triggered the process, but the official conclusion is they don't know why the pilots couldn't maintain straight and level flight. Now, I'm a big history buff. The Army Air Corps studied this back in the 1930s and concluded 90% of experienced pilots could not maintain straight and level flight if they couldn't see the horizon. So that's why they invented the artificial horizon way back then. And the pilots on that Air France flight, they had their artificial horizon in front of them that should have saved the day, but they also could not see the horizon. And the stall alarm was going off intermittently, and they're thinking computer error, and that adds to their confusion. But they should have been able to just maintain straight and level flight and fly out of it, which mostly happens. You know, pilots are not confused. That's why they're very experienced.
Well, I'm old enough to remember flying in a 747 when it was brand new. And about 2 months ago, the last commercial passenger plane that Delta flew, a 747, was mothballed in the Arizona desert. That is a 48-year-old airframe. And for the B-52, which has been flying now for over 60 years, that should give us, I guess, some confidence in the quality of the mechanical device that we're flying in.
Well, they actually last much longer than that. Typically, big passenger planes in first world countries are retired something like 25 to 30 years, but those planes do not disappear. Now, sometimes they're mothballed because the newer ones are more cost effective, but they typically become cargo planes or passenger planes in third world countries. They typically last 50, 60 years. Those planes are good for a long time. They can kind of last forever. They will wear out with metal fatigue and corrosion, but they know where the bad spots are. They can renew them and fly them a long time, hence the B-52.
There's a great movie called No Highway in the Sky, which is about metal fatigue as a factor in a plane crash. It starred Jimmy Stewart back in the early 50s. I remember it vividly. But the book is very interesting, George, and it's interesting even for somebody who's not a mechanical engineer, as we've been sharing these anecdotes and what was learned from them. George Bible is the author of Plane Crash, The Forensics of Aviation Disasters, co-authored with Captain Robert Hedges. Before, we've spoken to him about another book, Beyond the Black Box, The Forensics of Airplane Crashes, and Train Wreck, The Forensics of Rail Disasters. George, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up next, robotic milking.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
Giving to Prairie Public is as simple as sending a text. Just text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and set up the monthly deduction of your choice. $5, $10, $15, $20 a month? It's as simple as that. Here's the deal. You give what you can, and Prairie Public delivers reliable, fact-based journalism and outstanding top-shelf programs without commercial interruption or influence. Simple. So reach for your smartphone and text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and simply support Prairie Public today. And thanks.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. On a growing number of dairy farms, people don't decide when the cows need to be milked. The cows do. That's because those farmers have called in robots to do the milking, day or night. And for some families, the ones that run small dairies, the robots mean freedom. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
Carol and Bill Schuler and their two sons, Billy and Wyatt, run a dairy farm near the town of Baroda in southwest Michigan. And for decades, family life revolved around milking 40 cows.
At 3:45 every morning, the first thing we did, we would clean the barn out.
We fed the cows, we milked the cows, and then at 3:00 in the afternoon, it all started over again. Feed the cows, milk the cows.
Milking time is kind of like our meal time. You know, we were more likely to be together during milking time than we were during mealtime.
That was Bill, Billy, and Carol Schuler. There were no weekends off, no holidays. If there was a big family get-together like a wedding, Bill Schuler says, they'd get there late or leave early.
If you're a small operation and you can't hire help, you're a virtual slave to your farm.
On top of that, recent years have been really tough for dairy farmers. Milk prices have slumped, as they sometimes do. Farmers are eating into their savings. Some are giving up on dairying. Bill and Carol Schuler wondered if their two sons really would want this life. Their grandmother, Shirley Schuler, really had her doubts.
You couldn't encourage them because you know it isn't easy. You know it isn't easy.
But a couple of years ago, Billy and Wyatt told their parents they did want to be dairy farmers. And the Schulers decided to make a big investment for the future of the farm and the family. There's a big new barn on the farm now. Inside it, 100 cows spend their days lounging on sawdust. And every once in a while, one of them decides it's her own personal milking time. She strolls down to one end of the barn where there's a small trailer-sized building. She pushes through a metal gate and walks into that building, into a special cow-sized chamber that holds her in place. A sensor reads her ID tag, and a robotic arm swings into action, reaching toward her udder.
Okay, so here we go.
Yep. The first thing it's going to do is sanitize each teat with an iodine solution. Then it will go back and put the milkers on individually.
I see a little red light. Is that the...
Those are the lasers.
That's right, lasers. That's how the robot finds the teats. It takes the machine a couple of tries to attach the milkers. A human would do this much faster. But eventually it succeeds, and milk flows through hoses into a big storage tank. Bill Schuler's sons are usually here, but they don't have to be, at least not every minute. If something goes wrong, they'll get an alert on their phones. Robots are milking just a small minority of American cows, maybe 5%, but the share is growing. Big dairies are buying them to replace workers, often immigrants. Small farms have been getting them to replace family labor.
It absolutely changes your lifestyle. It gives you a life.
There's been a lot of talk lately about robots taking people's jobs. Bill Schuler hopes this robot will help his son stay in the dairy business.
If this technology was available 25 or 30 years ago, I'd still have more friends milking cows today. I have a friend, he's a couple years older than I am. I'm sure he would have robots. He'd still be milking cows today. His son would probably be there with him.
In fact, a small family-run dairy farm like this is rare enough these days, Schuler's turning it into a tourist attraction. Hundreds of people visited last year. Kids love the cows, he says. Older people are amazed by the robots. Dan Charles, NPR News.
That story originally aired on NPR's Weekend Edition. Coming up on Main Street, a cutting-edge podcast about helping teachers learn new ways to engage their students in math and science, and an interview about a 4,600-mile-long hiking trail that starts in eastern New York and ends in the middle of North Dakota. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. It could be the most expensive U.S. Senate race in history. Both candidates have predicted it could be $30 million or more.
My sense of it is that each of the campaigns themselves will be somewhere around, you know, $8 to $10 million.
Republican Kevin Cramer says that doesn't include outside money from unaffiliated PACs and interest groups. Cramer says it's almost frightening.
And when I say frightening, I don't just mean, you know, the $10 or $20 million that's coming at me. I mean the $10 or $20 million that's on my behalf. It's all frightening to me just by virtue of how much it is, first of all. And second of all, how so oftentimes the outside groups don't really get us, if you know what I mean. Get our culture, get our sort of style of politics.
By law, Kramer and incumbent Senator Heidi Heitkamp cannot coordinate with those outside groups, but Kramer says he will not be shy about speaking out.
If I see something coming from my side that is distasteful or outrageous, I absolutely will speak up.
Castleton State Senator Gary Lee says he plans to help the Public Service Commission in its quest to keep its rail inspection program intact. The legislature okayed it as a pilot program, but it expires next year. Lee helped get the program approved by the legislature. He says he thinks the two inspectors have done good work.
They'll need to prove that to the legislature and prove that to the rest of us. But I do think they have some things that tell us they've done good work, they've accomplished what they were supposed to do, and that I think we'll be satisfied with the work they've done. And
the two positions are paid for through a tax on the railroads. Lee says even though he's noticed less oil train traffic because of more oil moving by pipeline, the trains are still carrying a lot of potentially dangerous materials, so the state needs safe rails. And a new bipartisan group launching in Fargo this week is aimed at targeting corruption in state and local governments. Phil Davenport is a co-organizer of Represent Fargo, a local chapter of the national initiative called Represent Us. He says the group is organizing to fight corruption by working together to get amendments and laws passed that stop political bribery and secret money and improve the election system. Davenport says a recent independent corruption risk assessment by the Center for Public Integrity gave the state of North Dakota a D-. He says Represent Us has over 500,000 volunteers and members nationwide, so he's hoping there will be interest in the cause locally.
This is really an organization that can work with everybody. You know, it works for somebody like me who's retired, and we're looking to get young people involved in it because we've got that kind of spread. Corruption in this country affects all of us, and it's not something that's partisan. It's not left wing or right wing. Corruption is corruption. So we would encourage people of all ages to come out and join us because we can use everyone.
Davenport says liberals, conservatives, independents, and undecideds are invited to attend the group's first meeting held in Fargo this week. He says Represent Fargo will meet in the meeting room of the Natural Grocers on the corner of 13th Avenue and 45th Street on Wednesday, April 11th at 6:30 p.m. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The National Math and Science Initiative aims to help teachers learn new ways to engage students, and a training program for teachers called Laying the Foundation is coming up in June. In this excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast, Tom Gerhardt speaks with Ann Ellefson of the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, which oversees the program, and Damian Kennedy, a fifth and sixth grade teacher from Kidder County Steele Elementary, who's taken part in the training.
One thing that struck me as I was looking at the Laying the Foundation program is how significant of a difference it seems to make in the teacher training leading to results in the classroom.
Yes. The Laying the Foundation training is an in-depth, intensive professional development experience. The teachers commit a week of their summer to participate in whether it be math, science, or English language arts content areas. They have hands-on specialized opportunities for professional development, real engaging activities, taking some dry content areas and having some hands-on in-depth learning opportunities. The teachers really become students during that professional development time, but 4 days of intense learning has really transformed what's happening in our classrooms across the state.
What are some of the elements of the Laying the Foundation program, the training aspect, and what subjects do they concentrate on during that training?
So the training is provided for grades 3 through 12 teachers. We've had some teachers participate that are maybe outside of grade 3. So possibly a second grade student or maybe a Title I teacher has attended. Those teachers, by the just the natural skills and abilities of teachers, you adapt. You learn how to make it work for your classroom and for your environment. But those teachers that come and attend, they'll attend in the math curriculum reading language arts curriculum and or the sciences. And in particular at the high school, there'll be chemistry, biology, environmental science. So they'll have specialized instruction in those particular content areas. The teachers receive online learning resources and tools. It's actually a series of professional development. So if you attend 1 year, let's say, in biology, you would have 4 intense days of your biology training. You can follow that up with a second year where then you'll go through modules 4 through 8 and have another 4 years of training and then capstone it with a third year professional development and have modules 8 through 12. So really a teacher can participate in this professional development for 3 consecutive years and not repeat the same experiences and learning opportunities.
Damien, always great to have teachers in the mix and giving us their firsthand experiences. You've attended how many times? Tell me a little bit about the takeaway.
Right. I've had 1 year of laying the foundation training. It was fantastic. It's a great week. You get in there, get into the seat, and you become a student for that week. And it's a fantastic experience.
Any specific example you can think of that's made you a better teacher, or perhaps some of the ideas that you've been able to take back from the Laying the Foundation experience into your very own classroom?
Just this last month, we were doing fractions in fifth grade, and you know, I had a small pod of kids who were really struggling with the concept of equivalent fractions. So my mind immediately went to my Laying the Foundation module book, and I said, okay, I know there's one on fractions in here. And even though it was a third grade lesson, it really translated well to my fifth graders, where they got to create these nice fraction strips where they could visually see the equivalent fractions rather than just trying to wrap their mind around the multiplication and figuring out that fraction.
And this is for all teachers, obviously, but it seems like it could be really valuable for young teachers, people just getting into the profession and using the foundation as a connection. They're kind of laying a foundation for them in their careers.
Yes, because of a gift given by ExxonMobil to the National Math and Science Initiative in 2015, we're able to offer this to any and all North Dakota teachers. So it's open to new teachers. It's open to seasoned teachers. It's open to even teachers that have maybe been out of the profession but are looking to get back into the profession. So all teachers are welcome to attend the training in the summer.
The Cutting Ed podcast is all about innovative practices. How does the Laying the Foundation program fit under that umbrella? You mentioned hands-on activities, I think teachers collaborating, things like that. Tell us a little bit more from that aspect, how this is sort of leading the way into the future.
Part of innovative education is how we engage our students during the classroom experience. As adults, many of us experienced classes in a sit-and-get format where you are the digester of the information that's presented to you. The hands-on training that is presented in Laying the Foundation can really change that engagement and student participation in the classroom. The teachers are provided with materials and supports that are ready to go. It's not a curriculum that is provided to them, but it's supports to supplement what they're already doing in their classroom. So I really think it's at that student level that innovation really takes hold. When you provide instruction differently to students, whether it be in a whole class or a small group environment, when students are engaged with the content, different connections are made with that content, and they're able to carry that forward.
Damien, going back to the actual training, I wanted to hear what you had to say about how you're able to collaborate with other teachers and develop more of those ideas and have more material to bring back to your students.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, getting to meet with teachers from all around the state and hearing how they implement things in their classroom. And you get the Laying the Foundation materials, but also you get that collaboration with other teachers. I'm still in communication with 3 or 4 teachers that I was partnered up with in Laying the Foundation, where we bounce ideas off each other and help each other become best teachers.
Cutting Ed host Tom Gerhart speaking with Ann Ellefson of the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction and teacher Damien Kennedy. The registration deadline is this Wednesday, the 11th. We'll post a link on our archive page where teachers can register, plus a promo code that waives the registration fee. The Cutting Ed podcast is a collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dinter-Smith. Next on Main Street, the North Country National Scenic Trail.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Bob Stein. Bob is going to talk about the North Country National Trail Association. He's an avid hiker and backpacker. Bob, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Doug. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's start the basics here. What is this trail that we're talking about, the North Country National Scenic Trail?
Well, there's a system of national scenic trails, and you've heard of a couple of them, like the Appalachian Trail and the Pacific Crest Trail, and there's a few lesser known. I believe there's 11 of them nationally, but the North Country Trail is, by congressional delegation, one of these national trails. It's the longest of all of the national scenic trails. It's 4,600 miles and runs from in New York State near the Vermont border, and it zigzags its way to the southern shore of Lake Sakakawea right here in North Dakota, right near Pick City.
When did it get started?
It was designated a trail in the 60s. I don't know exactly the date, but
and
it was
when you say designated, National Park Service says this is okay, that kind of thing?
Designated by the National Park Service with congressional approval.
So how is the route chosen?
Well, the original route is put down, and it's kind of the points of least resistance because there, you know, the public lands, of course, are good places to site trails because we there's a pretty high probability that we can go through those at some place. But inevitably, there's places where you have to cross private land. So then in those cases, the original route will probably be on roads. And that gets us – what that does is it establishes a route, maybe not the preferred route, but is a route and gives us some place to start.
And this is a scenic trail, so the route obviously is intended to be someplace where you'd want to take a hike.
Yes, yes. And I know I've heard several times, you know, oh, I hike in North Dakota. There's nothing to see. Well, if you've never gone through a high-intensity agricultural production area, one of the best in the world, there is something to see. And there, I think there's great value in that, not only for us to see that, but for visitors who come and look at our landscape.
4,600 miles long. That's a very long trail. Do people aspire to walk the length of it?
Well, there have been a few. There have been a few. About 4 or 5 years ago now, Luke Jordan, he had just graduated from college, I believe, at Morehead State, and he was from St. Cloud. I think that's how it went. But he decided he wanted an adventure, and he did a five-month hike, and he started in March of 2013. And if you remember, 2013 was a little like 2018 in how the spring is going. So he walked on snowshoes from Lake Sakakawea State Park to all the way through North Dakota. And there's 427 miles of the North Country Trail in North Dakota.
Well, his thighs and calves might be in the Smithsonian by now then. Huh? That's quite a walk. How is the trail marked?
The trail is marked in a couple of ways. There are designated trailheads that we try and get them directions to them from the major roadways that go by, whether it be the interstate roadways or the state highway system. But then once on the trail, we use two means. We've got the logo of the North Country Trail, and then also our blue blaze. We just take, and there's a little, like you took about a 2-inch paintbrush and dipped it in the blue that's iconic to the North Country Trail logo, and paint a strip about 10 inches long on a fence post, on a tree branch, on a rock, whatever surface we can find that is going to be permanent.
And you publish maps?
We have maps, yes, we do. They're available in the rest areas, in the Convention Visitors Bureau. We try and spread them around wherever we can.
How many people do you think use this trail?
That's a real good question, and I don't know that I can give you a good answer. We have about 100 members in our trail association, and we plan trips. We have at least one planned hike every month.
And this is the North Country National Trail Association that has 100 members?
No. This is the Dakota Prairie chapter.
The local chapter.
Yes, we have a local chapter here. There are two local chapters in North Dakota. There's one based out of Valley City, which is the Cheyenne Valley chapter, and they take care of the trail from, near Fort Ransom up through Valley City and up to Lake Ashtabula by the Bald Hill Dam and then up north along Ashtabula. Then there is the Dakota Prairie chapter, which is our local chapter, and our segment of trail that we are responsible for runs from Fort Abercrombie, right on the Minnesota-North Dakota border, and then across country to Lisbon, and about 10 or 12 miles beyond Lisbon to the Cheyenne State Forest.
And the Dakota Prairie chapter has been very active in this North Country National Trail Association because Tom Moberg is an immediate past president. He's from Fargo. Jan Olvert Stewart in Fargo is a board member. You're active, obviously. So,
Yeah, we have a really good chapter. And we've done over the past several years, we've been fortunate to have a really good group of volunteers. And all the work done on this trail development is done by volunteers. We can get some grant money, the Heritage Fund money from the state, and there's a few other places. But most, all of the work is done by volunteers, and that includes getting right-of-way from private landowners, getting rights-of-way or easements or whatever document we need to do that, determining routes. If we need to change a route, we have to do a study and then turn that in to make sure that it meets the other guidelines. Then going out and signing the trail and then maintaining that trail. And if there's work that needs being done, such as, we don't have elevation. I was going to say switchbacks, but we really don't need switchbacks.
But you have a little creek or that, something like that, yeah. Every now and then, don't you?
We have to do benching is what it's called if you're walking on the side of a river and the bank is very slanted. We do benching to give you a flat walking path.
That sounds like hard work.
It can be very hard. And unfortunately, the people who have time to do it are people like me. We have time, and we have time because we're retired, and that means most of us aren't so young anymore.
All right. You've got an event coming up on a week from today. It's the Dakota Prairie Chapter's second annual hiking and backpacking expo in Fargo. What can people expect there?
Well, we find that there's a lot of people that really like to hike. And, they may not know where to go. They may not be experienced. They may not want to hike alone. They don't know what kind of equipment or gear they're going to need. So we decided last year we would do an expo, and we had it and had a very, very good reception to it. What we did was those of us in the hiking, the local chapter, we have a pretty broad range of experiences and equipment. So we just brought our equipment, and then we have that at the tables, and people can see the kind of equipment that we use and something that might work for them. In addition to that, we have tables that have maps for the various hiking trails, not just the North Country Trail. That, of course, is the one we're pushing. But we realize, too, that people are looking for hiking opportunities in other places, and they may want to go over by Valley City. That's beautiful hiking in that Cheyenne River Valley, Catherine, the scenic way or the scenic byway. There's some beautiful opportunities to see just wonderful trail along there, and that chapter has done some great, great work in trail development also. So it boils down to is finding people that have time and willingness and prioritize providing continued access to land for public hiking.
Well, it sounds like it's fantastic exercise. It sounds like it would also be an interesting walk to take to see interesting things we wouldn't otherwise see. How much does it cost to be a backpacking hiker? I mean, you need a backpack, you need a walking stick, you need good shoes. I mean, what else? What's it take?
Well, the beauty of it is you start by walking, and most people can get into that business rather efficiently. And we as a local chapter, we try and plan at least one hike per month year-round. So we have a variety of different conditions that we walk in. But some of them are longer. We may go out on a Saturday or a Sunday and walk 7 or 8 miles. We may have something where we go out and walk 4 or 5 miles. Over the winter, not knowing what the conditions were going to be on the trail, there were a couple times that we just hiked like 3 miles right here in the Fargo-Moorhead area. And then when we got done, we could stop at a coffee shop and warm up and have a good time. But we try and find a range of distances to hike because we want people to know there's something for everyone to do.
Well, you referenced Iron Leg Luke, who did the 4,600-mile walk from Lake Sakakawea to the border of Vermont. How much of this trail have you walked?
Oh, all told, I've walked probably 250 miles of it, not all in North Dakota, but over the years I've walked some in Minnesota and I've walked some in Wisconsin.
Why does it end in North Dakota? There's a lot of north left across the United States.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of trails that I think they'd like to try and hook up with. Continental Divide Trail that I'm not quite sure where that goes, but it's someplace to the west of Lake Sakakawea. And then when you go a little bit further and you get to the Rockies, you hit the Pacific Crest Trail. I expect someday there's going to be an effort to connect them, just like on the east end of the North Country Trail. There is a trail called, I think it's called the Long Trail, connects the North Country Hiking Trail with the Appalachian Trail.
Now, there are 100 members of the Dakota Prairie chapter here. How do people become a member? What's involved there?
Well, we can make that very simple. You can go online, North Country Trail website.
It's northcountrytrail.org.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. You can register there. You can come to one of our meetings. We publicize our meetings, and we have monthly meetings that are geared not for hiking necessarily, although we do a couple of them where our meeting is actually a hike. But we try and get speakers to come in to teach us something about the trail. At a recent meeting, we had the director of the Garrison Diversion Conservancy District. We've had biology experts from NDSU come and speak to us. We've had people talk about different aspects of the trail. National Forest Service person who was a manager of the Cheyenne Grasslands, we've had that person come and speak, just so we learn more about the areas that we're hiking through to get a little better idea of them. But we have those meetings once a month, and there's always an opportunity to join or learn more about joining there. Also at the expo, we'll have some folks there at a table who will be able to help anyone who may want to join.
And the expo is at the Wanzek Center for Scouting. It's a beautiful new facility in South Fargo.
Yes, I had never been there before, and I was very, very impressed with it. It is very nice. We have the inside space where we will have our tables, and we'll have the things set up. And at those tables, we're going to have different – we'll have one for backpacking, one for day hiking, one for hiking with families, you know, because there's a lot of people who say, well, I can't hike because we got two or three kids, you know. Well, you can still do the hiking.
You have to walk at their pace.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. And you have to make sure you have the things to keep them going, the water and the energy and the things like that. So we have about 8 different stations that people can look at, and we tried to address the common areas that people may question if they're going to take on something like this.
And, of course, you're at a scouting center, so maybe this is a way to inspire scouts to become members of the Dakota Prairie chapter.
Well, and, you know, we do have a great, great relationship with the scouting program. Young people who are working on Eagle Scout badges have built benches along the trail. And if you've ever done any backpacking and you've been walking for a few hours and your back is starting to ache a little bit and you see a bench, it's just – it's a beautiful sight, and the scouts, the Eagle Scouts have, and scouting, it's not just Eagle Scouts, it's troops who have come out there and helped us with construction on various facilities on the trail.
Well, it's a free event. It starts at 5 o'clock on Monday, that is April 16th, at the Wanzek Center for Scouting in South Fargo, and it runs until 8 o'clock. All kinds of subject matter will be dealt with. Bob Stein, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Doug. Pleasure to be here.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Alexa, play Prairie Public.
Welcome to Prairie Public. Would you like to listen to a radio stream or listen to a podcast?
Radio stream.
If you've got a smart speaker, you can listen to Prairie Public.
Which of the two streams would you like to listen to? Roots, rock, and jazz, or classical and news?
You can also ask Alexa to play Prairie Public Podcasts.
Would you like to listen to Main Street, Natural North Dakota, Chef Rosie, Dakota Datebook, Plain Folk, or Why?
All you have to do is ask.
Alexa, play Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 9th. Bow Bells is the county seat of Burke County, which is bordered on the north by the Canadian province of Saskatchewan. Bow Bells was founded in 1898 along the main line of the Soo Line Railroad and incorporated in 1906. Railroad officials named the town for the famous bells of the St. Marie-le-Bow Church in London. On this date in 1900, the Bow Bells Tribune announced that Bow Bells was located in one of the finest tracts of agricultural lands in North Dakota. Over 700 settlers had taken up land in the area. 120 people filed for land in just 1 month. The newspaper expected that within a year, 1,500 settlers will have moved into the area. This land in the Del Lac Valley was government land subject to the Homestead Act. The newspaper described it as dark, rich soil on a gentle incline towards the river. The soil was free of rocks and very fertile. There were indeed many incentives to entice settlers. The newspaper also cited an abundance of coal, which could be purchased at $1 per ton. Water could be found at a depth of 20 to 40 feet. The big draw was the potential for agriculture. The land was suitable for wheat, flax, and vegetables. The wheat yield in 1900 was expected to be 25 bushels per acre. The Tribune noted that besides agriculture, there were also openings for many different types of businesses. Bow Bells needed a livery stable and a general merchandise store. There were also opportunities for lumber and machinery. Bow Bells did thrive for a time. The courthouse was built in 1928, a distinctive building designed by a Minneapolis firm. It was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1985. But the population of the county fell. From a high of about 10,000 in the 1930s, the county population was down to around 2,300 in 2015. And Bow Bells itself, around 360. Bow Bells remains a prime agricultural area, with farmers producing wheat, barley, flax, canola, and sunflowers. The climate varies from warm, sometimes hot summers, to cold, often severely cold winters. Today's Dakota Daybook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg takes questions on Capitol Hill this week after reports of user data mishandled by a political firm.
I think it's a watershed moment both for policymakers and technology companies. They are now realizing how little the public understands about how data and social media environments work.
What's at stake as lawmakers examine how the tech world uses your data? On the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, we'll hear about the Scholastic Art and Writing Awards to recognize creative teens. Our Ashley Thornburg will talk with representatives of the Red River Valley Writing Project and the Plains Art Museum, the affiliates for North Dakota. And we'll meet Ross Lockhart of the Northern Small Farm Alliance, a group of farmers working to promote local food and help young people get into farming. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.